Happy Friday. Welcome to Minute 65, Great Escape Minute, the daily podcast where we dig into the Great Escape one minute at a time. I'm Tom.
And I'm Rob.
And joining us to close out the week is Richard Kirkham of Kirkham, A Movie a Day, and he's also the host of the Lambcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Day five. This is the capper.
Yes. We want to thank you for joining us all week here. Minute 65 starts with Big X saying, "You get 10 out of 10 for this old boy." And it ends with Big X again saying, "The goons would have a field day if they crashed." And we will find out the end of that sentence on Monday. So this minute here, we kind of wrap up the Forger's party. And everyone's just very much impressed with what Henley was able to get his hands on. And they ask him where he got it, which seems like a silly thing to ask a scrounger. But, and I love Henley's response. He says, "You," stops, and then says, "It's on loan." What was he going to say with "you"? I mean, is he going to say, "You don't want to know? You wouldn't believe me if I told you"? Like, what is he thinking he was going to say there? Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think he could have said either of those things, but he also wanted to say, "I'm going to need it back," without saying, "I'm going to need it back." So he switched and said, "It's on loan." And, you know, he's just a kind of a wise guy. He's not quite the smart ass that some of the other characters are, but he definitely has that American sense of humor. So he's gonna find a euphemism as a way of conveying to everybody what's going on here. It's important where I got it, but not important that you know where I got it. But it is important that you know I need it back.
Yeah. this is just my opinion, a screenwriting ploy. You know, they're just, you know, trying to add a little bit of humor into the whole thing by him saying, "Oh, it's on loan." Because obviously anyone who hasn't seen this before doesn't know what that really means. For those of us who've seen it, know what he's angling here. You know, what he's trying to say. I think it's just a way to end this particular scene. You know, by leaving us hanging a little bit by saying it's on loan, meaning that, okay, we're not done with this.
Right.
You know, be prepared that this is going to come up again. That's what I think.
Well, and the other thing laughed at is, you know, my experience in the military is when you're either staff NCO or your OIC says, "I need X, Y, and Z." Once you get X, Y, and Z, they don't ask you where you got it, or at least the ones with some experience in the good staff NCOICs and officers just don't ask questions that they don't need or don't want the answers to. I cannot count how many times I've acquired things that we needed for an inspection or, you know, something like that. And it's like, "Nope, it's there. It wasn't there yesterday. It's there today. Don't worry about where it came from, sir. Just accept the fact it's there and let's move on with this." So I did laugh at Big X asking, "Where did he get it?" You know better.
Right. Okay. But maybe it has to do with the fact that they're in different branches of service, you know.
True.
Or different, you know, he knows that
different nationalities. He's a Brit.
No, but Henley's still in the RAF. He's in the American Eagle Squadron.
Yeah.
But he's still in the RAF. But maybe, you know, the Americans do things differently. Maybe this is very proper British that they don't, you know, look for things. You know, maybe in the RAF, if you find something, you put up a notice and say, "Okay, who lost the canteen?"
Wait, beer drift isn't a gift in the British military? That seems silly.
I don't know. I'm just I'm trying to look at it from another perspective that maybe, you know, I'm trying to, that Roger's giving you the benefit of the doubt.
There's less need for plausible deniability in the British military than there is in the American military.
Apparently.
So once we get that, we move inside a different barracks room and we get a scene with Griffith explaining to Roger all the different things they can do with the service jackets. Which I am relatively impressed with, in part because making it, I find making a double-breasted suit out of a non-double-breasted jacket to be fairly impressive, unless you're taking a big guy on base and making a jacket for a little guy on base.
Right. I mean, the it's interesting the way that they show this, you know, that he's based, it makes it seem as if Roger's in, you know, a clothing store. You know, he's walked into the clothing store, he's talking to the seller, or maybe it's the tailor himself or whatever. And he's basically saying, okay, what do you have to offer me? And he says, well, you know, I can take what you have and make it a double-breasted suit. I can make it a single-breasted suit. I can make it a lounge suit. Now, I had no idea what a lounge suit is. Do either of you have any idea what a lounge suit is?
No.
It's probably similar to a leisure suit. You know, it's, I think it's a style that was typical in Europe years ago, but you're not going to find it much anymore. It's a little bit like that robe that Sean Connery wore at the beginning of Goldfinger when he's in Miami. So, this whole scene is basically exposition to explain something that we might be curious about, but we're not that curious about. And he does a nice job quickly running us through all of the details about how this could be done quickly. And you're right. It's sort of like he's in a men's shop doing this.
Now, I looked up what a lounge suit is because I was very curious. And it's apparently an informal type of suit, but a gentleman would always want to look his best. So they were still reasonably smart. And they said for working class men, a lounge suit would be their Sunday best. So, you know, I guess that's what, you know, working class men would wear to church. That's basically what they're saying here. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, this comes up later. The whole idea of them taking, you know, their uniforms and recutting them. The book also goes into much detail about this whole thing. So this is something that they really did. The tailor they had was really able to take all of their uniforms and find ways of making them look like suits, like you know, typical German civilian clothes. And I mean, we'll discuss. I mean, he keeps discussing. He goes on and discuss about the lapels, how he can change the lapels and stuff like that. I mean, apparently Griffiths must have been a tailor in civilian life. You know, I don't think he was in the. I'm trying to remember what it's called. You know, I don't think he was dealing
quartermaster corps.
Thank you. I don't think he was in the quartermaster corps because again, he's a pilot, and maybe he went out for a joyride too, like Colin. You know, and got shot down.
I had to laugh, though, during this whole scene, because it gave me flashbacks. So when I got married, my wife took me to the tux shop to pick out tuxes for the groomsmen and stuff. And the guy at the shop was giving me the rundown of what different tux styles they have, and I swear I must have just glazed over like a deer in a headlights when he was talking about these things. He looks at me and goes, this suit, Sean Connery Bond. And
there you go.
It immediately, once he started telling me which Bonds wore which suits, it automatically clicked for me. And I just watching Griffith do the different things with the suits just made me think about that. Like, oh no, Roger clearly doesn't care about fashion, so I need to sit here and show him this is what the double-breasted jacket looks like. This is single-breasted. This obviously, Roger probably knows what a double-breasted jacket looks like, but it gives that exposition but even in the 60s, I have to feel like most people would have a pretty good idea of what these things look like. So interesting they did.
What do you mean? What do you mean even in the 60s? I think especially in the 60s. Especially in the 40s. I mean, this was, you know, back during World War II, people wore suits than people do. You know, there wasn't the casual.
Right, but even in the 60s, I'm saying when the movie came out, there would still be a better knowledge of what suit cuts were what than there is today. Not as strong as in the 40s, but still much stronger than today. Because 60s was when that casual was really more coming into style.
Right. I mean, I think Roger does know that the various cuts, but the idea here is to show that we can take a typical uniform and turn and transform them into these civilian, you know, clothes.
Yeah, not everybody's going to look the same coming out of the tunnel. They're going to look different, and we want diversity of appearance so that we can pass in the civilian population when we're outside of camp. They need kind of variety.
No. Especially when they'll probably have so much dirt on them from coming out of the tunnel. But that's a separate issue. This movie doesn't deal with dirt. I mean, come on, Henley, we've discussed this in the past. Henley's sweater looks really clean. You know, he's got a white turtleneck. Thank you. Yeah, he's got a white turtleneck. There's no way that, think about it. He bailed out of his plane, landed somewhere, got captured. He's been in a prison camp for X amount of time, and it's all still white. That's pretty good. Yeah. That's impressive. and I had heard of double breasted. I know what a double breasted suit and a single breasted suit is. As I said, I didn't know what a lounge suit is. But when you talk about lapels, I didn't know anything about that. I don't know what a deep lapel is or a high lapel. And basically, Roger doesn't care either because he just cuts them off. he says, "What about the buttons?" Like, stop telling me about lapels. I don't care about lapels. What about the buttons?
And out comes the bucket of buttons. And that's exactly the one that I'm curious about, because if you've got a suit, you've got to have at least 3 buttons that match. And I don't know where you get all the buttons that are going to match. If you're going to fool people, there has to be some uniformity in the way that the clothes are put together. You can't have 3 different button styles on your jacket and have people say, "Oh, yeah, that's a suit that the guy got down at the shop there on Hulldorfstrasse," or whatever the name of the streets are. they've got to have some consistency. And he's got a whole jar of buckets, a jar full of buttons. And I'm just wondering, is this, it's kind of a depressing thought. Are these the buttons off of the dead officers over the years?
No, but again, they mentioned that these are civilian buttons.
Yeah, but some of the buttons off of the suits, off of the uniforms would probably pass. Just depends on what kind of uniform you were wearing. Obviously, if you've got a brass button, that's not going to work. Or if you've got something with an insignia on it.
Right, and but, the RAF jackets that a lot of the officers are wearing in the movie, it doesn't seem like most of them have it, but the buttons on the uniforms had like an embossed like crown and eagle on them for the RAF uniforms. So you'd have to
grind. You probably didn't want to walk around Germany with those.
Right.
Yeah. So these buttons had to come from somewhere. I'm just curious where they came from.
Okay, again, the book does describe it. The book goes into much more detail about how they got the buttons. They made contacts with many of the guards who they bribed with so many things. And it's funny, when I was reading it, it reminded me of Shawshank, you know, with the way that they talk about how you can pretty much get anything for a price. And that's what it came down to. You know, they said that there was this private who was able to, they even persuaded him to bring in a pair of pliers for them to use. And they paid him in chocolate.
I can imagine, to a certain extent, you can get some sort of sewing kit that has buttons on it to some level, just in a Red Cross. You know, you're in POW camps. Eventually, buttons are going to fall off. You're going to need replacements. So you can store up some of that, but you're going to need to get outside help to get mass amounts of matching buttons that...
Correct.
Yeah, so it makes sense. Correct. They bribe off guards. But...
Yeah, and the book goes even a little further to explain that this particular guard, they gave him the chocolate for the pliers. They had him sign a receipt for the chocolate, and they used that as leverage to get him to bring in so many other things. He brought in passes, money, files, maps, tools, and even German uniform buttons and badges. You know, they really got him just for that. So, I mean, there were ways for them to get all these things. The whole question then is that as you mentioned earlier, you know, you need to have matching buttons. So, you know, if you're going to bribe someone to bring in buttons, how many buttons are you going to get them to bring? You know, bring in 3 buttons, bring in 10 buttons. it shows that they knew how to get things when they needed to.
Somebody was definitely resourceful.
Yes, they were very resourceful. Did any of you notice right after they talk about the buttons, we get to see another slick in the wall?
Yes, and I had, this seems like a really big slick in the wall.
Okay, but we've discussed this in the past. I mean, the book describes it, that they would build fake walls. This is a fake wall. This isn't just a slick.
Right.
The room is smaller because they built this fake wall that when the Germans would come in, they wouldn't even notice. You know, I mean, he keeps it open, which is really fun also.
Right, but we also discussed there's
he basically built a closet.
Right, but we've discussed there's a limit on how big you can make it. You can make the, how much smaller you can make the room before someone notices. And it seems awfully big, because he basically, it's hard to tell exactly from the camera angle, but he pretty much turns around in it. And it also seems deeper than the room.
He made a closet. He has a walk-in closet. the first walk-in closet in history.
Yes, because it seems to go past the end of the room and into what I assume must be the hallway. So did they make the hallway shorter, too?
It depends on the camera angle. Well, that's what it comes down to.
Well, it looks like it's at arm's depth. Because that's as far as he goes into it.
Right.
He doesn't actually go into it and walk in.
He doesn't go into it, but by looking at what he has in there, should say. I mean, he has things hanging up. It's not as if he's just a pile of clothes in there. It's all neatly piled up, neatly hanging there.
Right. He's got at least two lines in there. The top line looks empty, but it's vibrating. So maybe the top.
And the stuff's hanging on it, but it's not hanging on hangers. It's just draped over things.
True.
Yes. So they have a clothesline. They have a clothesline with the stuff hanging on it. Right. Yeah. That's what it actually looks. Yeah. It's hard to tell how deep it is.
It might be the lighting, because it looks like the far end of it's lit, which makes it look deeper than maybe it actually is. But they just had it for camera purposes.
Yeah, right. Which we discussed a few weeks ago about the lighting in the German POW camp, you know, how they really had good cinematic lighting.
Yeah, well, the light makes it look like it's a corner and there's a closet instead of it just being the wall. But I think you're right. It is a slit in the wall that they've got a fake wall here that goes all the way to the end. We can't really tell it goes the width of the room, at least.
That's the way it seems. And I love the way that Griff compliments himself he says he can dye it. He had a bottle of blue ink and he dyed it. And he goes, looks rather good, doesn't it? Meaning, I'm so proud of myself for being able to do that.
It'll pass.
It looks more, I mean, it's hard to tell which color it is just because of the way the shadows are, but it definitely, I think of the one he dyed blue looks far more black than blue.
But no, it looks blue to me.
Was Roger holding the blue one and he has Roger, the black one?
No. Roger's also holding, but Roger's, actually, the color of the suit that Roger's holding is very similar to the color of Roger's uniform.
Right.
That blends in. But what Griff is holding something that is definitely darker blue. There's no question about that.
Right. It's substantially darker. So, wow. Like I said before, I was an 8-color box of crayons kid growing up, so choosing colors is not my strong.
No, I understand. I saw something recently about, you know, showing the way that men see colors and women see colors. And it showed, you know, men the colors are, as you said, the 8 colors. And then women see colors and, goes into much more detail.
Yeah, what color dress is it that we're looking at, remember? Is that the gold dress or is it blue? Do you remember that
I do.
Thing from a few years ago?
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, Rob, do you have anything else for this minute?
No, I think I'm done for the week.
Richard, do you got anything else for this week or anything you want to say about the movie as a whole?
I'll just say that the movie is great, and I look forward to listening to all of the episodes that you get to, although that's a lot of damn minutes that we're covering here, because it's a long movie.
No, but it's only 1 minute a day. Yeah, it's only, you know, you don't have to listen, you're not listening to all of them at once.
Yes, that's true, but how many days is that going to be? We're going to have at least a year, almost.
172 days. No, not a year.
Oh, that's half a year.
35 weeks. But we know that you're going to persevere just like everyone else is listening, and just like we did.
We'll see.
We will.
We'll see how it all comes out.
Well, thank you for joining us all week, Richard. You want to tell everyone where they can find you one last time?
Sure. One more time. I can be found at Kirkham A Movie A Day. That's my personal blog. And you can also locate me at the site of the LAM, the Large Association of Movie Blogs, at largeassmovieblogs.com. where I am the host of the weekly podcast. We call it the Lambcast. And anybody who's interested in joining us, feel free to email us. We're happy to have new blood.
All right. Well, while you're checking that out, go ahead and, while you're checking out the Lambcast and subscribing to that, go ahead and subscribe to this podcast and give us a 5-star review. If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us. Our email address is thegreatminute@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter @greatescapemxm, or you can join our Facebook group, The Cooler, or you can just go ahead and check out our website, thegreatescapeminute.com. Until Monday, tally-ho.
Tally-ho.
Tally-ho.